Well, this is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra music director Stephen Larson. We are discussing the RSO's Classics 4 concert, Schubert Revisited, on Saturday, February 16th, 7:30 p.m., at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. The program begins with a relatively short piece, Beethoven's King Stephen Overture, Opus 117. Why did Beethoven write this music?
Well, like he did for most of everything else he wrote, because he got paid for it. It was a commission. The capital city of Hungary, well, there were two cities at the time, Buda and Pest, right across the river from each other, were celebrating the name day, the birthday of the emperor, and they were doing a series of commissions for various plays, composers, music, for the occasion. And Beethoven was commissioned to write a piece on some Hungarian themes. And actually, he wrote two pieces on these Hungarian themes with libretto by a librettist that was chosen by the emperor. One was King Stephen, and the other was the Ruins of Athens. Both of these were dramatic works, and Beethoven wrote, as he did for several other pieces, incidental music to these pieces. Incidental music means that you would start with an overture, and you would maybe write an aria or a chorus or two or three or something, with perhaps some music to go in between the scenes. Actually, this ended up being postponed a little bit, we ended up with two pieces out of this: the King Stephen Overture, and as it's really called most often today, just King Stephen, which is an acknowledgement of the fact that nobody ever does the rest of the music. It's just King Stephen, so let's just forget with the overture part of it. And the Ruins of Athens. And the Ruins of Athens tend to be done more often in their entirety with the choruses and everything. The only piece that's hung on from the King Stephen portion of this has been the overture. And it appears a fair amount on concert programs. It's not as popular as two of his more dramatic overtures, like the Coriolan Overture or the Egmont Overture, which has a little bit more about what we think about Beethoven, you know, the dramatist, the Fifth Symphony Beethoven. This is a little bit lighter in nature, but still it's mature Beethoven. It's I kind of have the feeling in listening to this piece that Beethoven was really having a good time writing it. It was not not serious thinking. It wasn't great, you know, momentous art. It was just fun music to write.
Plus, he got paid for it.
And he got paid for it, yeah. What could be better?
Absolutely. Well, following Beethoven, we come to a modern-day composer, Golioff. I got close, anyway. Who was born in Argentina in 1960. And you will be presenting his work, She Was Here, which four songs for soprano and orchestra. And the audience might not be as familiar with this composer. Can you give us some background on him?
Yes, he was born in Argentina. His parents were Eastern European Jews who had moved to Argentina. And Argentina is a very interesting place musically to be from, particularly from this period, because he was brought up in a house that with a lot of contact with Jewish liturgical music, Jewish folk music, and the klezmer bands, and also with the traditional Argentinian music, especially the music of Astor Piazzolla, the wonderful tango composer who was just becoming popular during his youth. When he was in his teens or his 20s, I forgot now when it was exactly, he moved to Israel and studied in Israel before coming back to the United States and getting a PhD in composition here from the University of Pennsylvania. He has done a lot of very interesting pieces, some rather dark, some rather exotic. He became very famous with his Passion According to St. Mark, which was premiered by Helmut Rilling, which really kind of created a sensation. And he's a composer that you'll see his work appearing quite often on the seasons of various symphony orchestras. He's gotten to be quite popular, but he's very hard to pin down where exactly he comes from musically, because he has all of these different influences that he's putting together.
So, tell us about the four songs. I believe, if I understand correctly, they're actually orchestral versions of four songs by Franz Schubert.
Schubert, yes. One of the things that Schubert is probably, I think, probably his greatest achievement, his greatest legacy, is the hundreds of songs that he wrote. The Lieder, written for voice and piano, and so incredibly complex and rich, using all the great German Romantic poets at the time. And writing this not just a song with accompaniment, but a piece of music in which the singer and the pianist were really equals. So it was really a work of art, like nothing that had really been written up to this point. And Golijov took four of these songs, actually four of the best known of Schubert's Lieder, and did something very unusual. Now, lots of composers have taken songs and have orchestrated them, taken the piano accompaniment and done an orchestral version. Golijov goes a step further here. He takes the piano accompaniment as sort of just a starting point, and then feels free to write whatever he wants to in place of it. So it's not just a transcription of the piano, it is incorporating the instruments of the orchestra in a very interesting and colorful new accompaniment to the piece. All the while, the song has not been changed. The Lied itself, the words are the same, the notes are the same. It's untouched. It's just the only thing that's different is that what is accompanying, what is framing the song itself is different. And it's very colorful, very exotic. Nothing terribly dissonant or strange, but it takes these early 19th century romantic songs and puts them in a whole different sonic world. And Golijov writes that he was in a very difficult place psychologically when he wrote this. He was quite depressed when he first started writing this. And these pieces are, in a way, I think, a kind of his way of coping with that depression. They're not depressing to listen to in any way, shape, or form, but they really are. They make you sit and think, "Ooh, that was interesting. What did I just hear?"
Mm-hmm. That sounds cool.
Yeah.
Who's going to be the soprano singing the songs?
A fabulous Dutch soprano, Josephine Stoppelenburg, who I've actually known since she was about 16. Because quite by chance, 20 years ago or something like that, a representative of the Haydn Youth Orchestra from the Netherlands called during the summer and said, "We're looking for a place to do a concert on our American tour. Can we find some place to do it in Rockford?" And I said, "Sure," and we made an arrangement for them. They performed at Memorial Hall, and Josephine and her sister were the featured soloists. Her sister is a mezzo-soprano. And she was just outstanding, just a beautiful, beautiful voice. And quite a number of years later, I discovered that she was here in the United States, and she was singing here. And I hired her to sing the soprano part in Handel's Messiah, which we did probably 10 years ago or something like that. And the voice was even more beautiful than I remembered it. And so is she, for that matter, if that matters. Striking young woman with a beautiful, just creamy voice that just melts in your heart. And when I decided I wanted to do the Golijov, she was the first person I thought of, because I thought, what a perfect voice for this kind of a piece. And since the pieces end with a kind of they're sort of subdued. There's not a whole lot of fireworks. I thought she needs something to kind of perk up the audience a little bit, and to end the first half of the program with a little bit of pizzazz. So I talked to her and I said, "Well, what about the Alleluia from Mozart's Exultate Jubilate?" And she said, "Well, perfect." I said, "Well, that'll do it."
Well, then she goes on and does perform that piece. That's what's on the program next, from Mozart. I believe the creation of this piece is related to the performance in Italy of a Mozart opera that didn't go too well.
No, well, he was 16. You give the guy a break, you know. he was on an extended tour of Italy with his father. He was 16 years old and trying to find his way. And he was commissioned actually to do an opera, which he called Lucio Silla, in Milan. And it didn't go over very well. There were a number of problems. Not so much Mozart's problems, but again, he was 16. And he was learning the craft of writing opera along with everything else he was doing in his life. But the male singer who sang a soprano role, this is back in the days of the castrati, young boys who had wonderful voices were castrated before their voices changed to preserve that the soprano voice. And the castrati at this time, they could become very famous and very, very rich. And this particular castrato named Rauzzini got along very well with Mozart, and Mozart loved his voice, so he decided to write a piece for him, a motet for a solo voice and orchestra. A sacred text that he called Exultate Jubilate, and in three movements. And the last movement simply has the text Alleluia. A lot of coloratura singing, a lot of brilliant showcasing the voice with a wonderful climactic high C right near the end. Always a lot of fun to listen to. And really, probably Mozart's first real success as an individual composition. Written, I think it's Kirchel 165. So Mozart's Kirchel numbers go up to 600 and something, in the low 600s. So you can tell this is written fairly early in his life because the Kirchel numbers are chronological. As they get higher, he gets farther along in his life till finally the Kirchel number of the Requiem, I don't remember what it is 608 or something like that. And that was his last work.
So this was really, by many people consider this his first masterpiece then.
It probably is. It was done before he moved to Vienna. He was still living in Salzburg with his father and still kind of finding his way. It really wasn't until he moved to Vienna that he began to really start to turn out what we now consider to be his best works.
So after this, we move along to Symphony in B Minor Unfinished by, I guess I referred to him as the star of Classics 4.
Yeah, he gets some repetition here.
Franz Schubert. Why was it unfinished?
There's been a lot of discussion about this, and it sounds like almost like a subject for a detective novel. Why didn't Schubert finish his Eighth Symphony? Well, truth be told, there was a lot of pieces that Schubert didn't finish. He was extremely prolific, and he wrote over... he died at age 31, I think. He wrote over 1,000 works during that fairly short lifetime. Quite a few of them he didn't finish. Why are we so hung up on this particular piece? Because there was another symphony he didn't finish, too, that people really don't even know about. Well, it's because the first two movements of this piece are just so doggone good that... it wasn't performed for the first time till 1865, years after 27 years or something after Schubert died, and it wasn't until it was first performed that people said, "Holy cow, this is incredible! This is really great!" And they were absolutely right because 1822, when it was first written, Beethoven was still alive. He wasn't writing much anymore, but the first two movements are so unusual, so unlike the Viennese symphonies that had become so popular, the symphonies of Haydn, the symphonies of Beethoven, symphonies of Mozart. Schubert, at age 22, comes along and writes these first two movements that are like nothing else written during this time. They seem to be decades and decades and decades ahead of their time. And so people, there was a lot of speculation about, well, why didn't he finish it? And some people said, well, he didn't have to finish them because they were perfect. He really intended this to be just two movements because they were the greatest two movements ever written. And it's a nice story, but it's not true because he started to write the third movement, didn't finish it. And he talked apparently to some of his friends about what would constitute the fourth movement. But again, the years went on. He lived for six more years and never got around to finishing the piece, along with quite a few others.
Well, someone did finish it, though, didn't they?
A number of people, actually. A number meaning less than 10. Musicologists have always, anytime there's an unfinished work out there by a great composer, somebody wants to find out not only why it was unfinished, but, gee, maybe do we have enough notes that we could somehow finish it or see what he was thinking about? And, of course, in Schubert's case, he actually wrote several pages of piano score and then orchestrated about 20 bars of the third movement. So a number of musicologists, and in this particular case, a British musicologist named Brian Newbold, who was a Schubert scholar, decided to see what he could do. And he took this partially completed third movement, and knowing everything he knew about Schubert's style and what Schubert wrote for third movements of symphonies and pieces in sonata form, he decided to try to write a completion, to sort of try to channel Schubert, so to speak, and to come up with a what if. What if he would have taken this, had a chance to take this idea and run with it? What would it have sounded like? And then he acted on the idea that Schubert had told some of his friends that, well, let me back up a little bit. Later that year, in 1822, Schubert wrote some incidental music to a play called Rosamunde, which is totally faded from the earth at this point. All we know now about it is really pretty much Schubert's music to it. But he wrote an overture, which is really another quite good piece, and incidental music, an on-track, two on-tracks, actually, and a bunch of vocal music that goes with this particular play. Reportedly, Schubert mentioned to some of his friends that he intended to use the first on-track from Rosamunde as the fourth movement of his B minor symphony. Mm. It starts in B minor, it ends in D major. That in itself is a little bit unusual, but at this particular time, people were beginning to do that sort of stuff. The idea of ending, B minor and D major, if you know music theory, they're relative keys. They have the same key signature. They're closely related to each other. Normally what a composer would do is they would start the movement in B minor and end in B major, but it wasn't unheard of to go to the relative major and start from B minor and then go to D major at the end, which is what happens in this on-track. So we have an opportunity to hear what might have happened had he had the chance to finish it. Another interesting thing about the first two movements is that they're quite long by the standards of the time. You put those first two movements together and you've got, depending on your tempo, maybe 40 minutes of music, half an hour to 40 minutes. This is long for two movements. Which made some people think that maybe he really didn't intend to go any further. Well, his ninth symphony is close to an hour long, so we know he was thinking big by this point. Unfortunately, he never got to hear the piece, even the first two movements. It wasn't published until 1867, I think, and not given his first performance again until 1865.
What made you decide to feature the symphony? Was it the uniqueness of it?
Well, first of all, the piece is worth doing, even in its incomplete form. It gets performed a lot. It's one of his most popular works. And I wanted to do the piece, and then I thought, well, what about, let's explore one of the completed versions. And I looked into the Newbold piece, and I said, okay, let's do this. It'll be interesting. Maybe our audience will never hear it again. And I have under no delusions that this is going to become a popular version, that people are going to say, oh, I want to hear the symphony, but only in the completed version. No, it'll be a little more Schubert, some very good Schubert at that. Whether you want to swap it for the unfinished version or not, that's up to you.
Well, let's move on to one other thing that we have not been discussing, and we should be, sound bites. Can you tell us about sound bites?
Sound bites is a kind of an institution now. We've been doing it for a number of years, but we do it on Friday afternoon, Friday at noon. I guess people actually assemble at about 11:30 at Montecito Country Club. You can order lunch there. And at noon, I sit down with the featured soloist or somebody connected with the concert, and we talk. And this isn't a pre-concert talk or pre-concert lecture. We don't discuss the music. We discuss what it's like being a musician for this person, and what they, how they started, and where they went to school, and where they got started, and what problems they ran into, and it can go on for there to wherever we want it. Wherever we want to take it. People get to ask questions. It's probably the only chance that you get to actually sit down in the same room with a guest artist and to ask them that question you've always wanted to know about you know, what do singers do before they go on stage? You know, what is it really true that you can't drink milk when you sing? You know, this stuff like this. So it's fascinating. It's always fun to find out that person who is performing, will be performing the next night, is not a just a musical entity unto themselves, but they're also a human being. Mm-hmm. And they're fascinating, they're fun, sometimes they're funny. But I always enjoy these. They're unscripted. And you get a pretty good lunch at your own expense during the process. But it's something I always look forward to, and I always wish that we had a few more people coming to these. They're really worthwhile coming to. If you have noon hour free on Friday, come and join us.
Yeah, I think that sounds very exciting. So your next one obviously will feature your soprano.
Yes, February 15th at Montecito. And Josephine will be there, and it'll be good to see her again. She's delightful.
Great. Well, Franz Schubert is indeed revisited at Rockford Symphony Orchestra's Classic Four concert on February 16th at 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. For more information about this concert, sound bites, and more, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.